Our next speaker is, the title of his presentation is Success Through Education, Technology, and Perseverance. Judge David M. Samowski from San Diego, California. Judge Samowski is assigned to the San Diego Criminal Court. Areas to be covered in his presentation are law school challenges, employment experiences, motivation, networking, ambition, law practice obstacles, and adaptations, judging pro and con, and finding happiness and success in life. Please join me in welcoming Judge Samowski to our convention.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Can you all hear me? Yes. All right, good. Is that what I was supposed to talk about? I was making some further notes at home this morning and rearranged things a little bit, but I think we're going to touch on all of that. Thanks for welcoming me to your statewide convention, I think it is, correct? All right, it's the first time I've been here, and welcome to San Diego if you're not from here. We have a nice day for you for a change. It's been a little warm. I got into the situation that brings me to an organization like this, having been in the military after my college days, and I was injured in Vietnam, which is where I lost my eyesight. So I come at blindness from a little bit of a different perspective maybe than some of you. When I went through my rehab process through the VA system at Hines, Illinois, I was quite a bit younger. It was 1969. I was 23 years old. And when I finished that, I was wondering what I was going to do with the rest of my life, and decided that I thought I would try to go to law school. So I applied to some law schools, I got into one, and my law career sort of started then at the University of Denver. And it was a big experiment back in 1970 because 5 blind students were admitted. And I don't think they had a blind person in that law school for maybe 20 years before that time. So it was kind of interesting for us as 5 blind people and interesting for the school because they weren't quite sure what they were doing or how it was going to work. But I did get through law school in the time that most people do. It's about 3 years. I went to summer school, so I actually finished a semester or a quarter early. And I went through school at that time with readers who usually were other law students, figuring if they were really going to do the work and read it, they might as well read it to me and I'd pay them a couple bucks an hour. That was a lot of money back then. And I used tape recorders in my classes. I recorded the lectures. I didn't know Braille real well. I knew the symbols, obviously, but speed was another factor. Being newly blinded, I'm not real proficient at it. Even 40 years later, I use it, but I certainly don't use it to the extent that others might. But then at night, I would take the tapes home. I would listen to them again. So I figured I went to law school twice. And figured the government got their money's worth having sent me to law school. And I synthesized all the tapes at night, and maybe an hour's lecture became 10 minutes of stuff that I thought was important to try to remember when exam time came. So anyway, I got through law school, and I took the bar exam in Colorado, passed it, then had some difficulty landing on my feet in the legal field, and I'll come back and talk about job searching and things like that in a minute. But after a while, things weren't working for me in Colorado, so I decided, where would I like to live? I was footloose and fancy free, single. I thought, let's go to Hawaii. Oops, dog quarantine. And I had a dog, and I still have a dog, number 5 today. So I said, all right, mentally I traced back, where would I like to live? And so I came to San Diego, because that was the first stop on the mainland as you're coming back from Hawaii. And I didn't know anybody, but I moved out here in 1976 and got involved in a local congressional campaign for something to do, because I wasn't quite sure where I was going to end up. And finally, in 1977, I really got my first job, and that was with the Veterans Administration as a counselor for veterans. I did that for about 3 years, and then I decided, I went to law school, I passed a bar in one date, I ought to really give it a shot. And so I left the VA, I took the bar exam here, and after I passed it, an opportunity through the Federal Government's Action Committee, which I don't think is in existence now, had veterans leadership groups starting around the country to help change the image of Vietnam veterans, which was kind of negative at the time. And I started the San Diego office, and I did that for about a year and a half before I really decided I needed to try and go to work as a lawyer. I applied for jobs. I actually got some interviews, which I thought was a plus. Some corporate interviews, some firm interviews. And ultimately, I just missed the hiring process in the district attorney's office. So I had some friends who had a law firm practice, and they offered to let me office with them and see what business I could get. So I made the critical mistake early on of thinking appearance meant a lot. So I spent a lot on furniture. And I paid my share of the rent. And I borrowed $50,000 from the Small Business Administration. And a year later, I was broke. So that was a lesson that was a good lesson, actually. But I realized that getting people to come in the door and see you was going to be a challenge. I went to bar meetings. I went to seminars. I went to subject to topical area seminars to meet other lawyers, pass out business cards, which were probably a little too glossy. That's probably where some of the 50 grand went. And I got a little bit of business. I did a little bit of corporate work. I did some wills and some trusts, and I did a couple of little criminal things, misdemeanor things. But I ran out of money, and I just couldn't stay officing with these guys because I wasn't able to pay my bill. But about that time, I did go back to the district attorney's office for an interview, and the timing was good. And one thing led to another, and I was hired, and in 1986, I went to work as a deputy district attorney and went through all the things new lawyers do. I did misdemeanors, I did issuing of cases, and then I got transferred to a branch office where I started doing trials with misdemeanors. And 4 years later, I came back downtown to do felony trials. And ultimately, at the time I was appointed to be a judge in 1998, I was doing the disposition conferences for felony cases, which was kind of a critical role in most all district attorney's offices, because if you don't settle the cases, the courts are going to be jammed. And as you may know, 90, 95% of the cases settle before trial. I worked in the law office with my friends by paying a reader to come in and help me with what was needed. In the district attorney's office, I was fortunate enough to have an enlightened DA who saw the value of my having a paralegal, and he paid for it, so that was good. So I hired a lady that worked with me for most of my DA career until her she got ill and had to leave. But they gave me somebody else to work with for the balance of the time I was there. And she was able to do research for me. And at the time, I had the old Kurzweil scanner that stood about 3 feet high. And I started with the Keynote. Some of you may remember that. That's what I started with. But mostly, it was reading and taking some notes in Braille with the old Perkins Brailler, which I still have. And doing trials. I loved being a lawyer because it meant when the game started, I get to stand up, I get to talk, and I get to do the job, fall flat on my face if I'm going to, but there's nobody there who's going to take the credit or suffer the ignominy if it doesn't work out. And it obviously, being a prosecutor to me was very important. I try to do the right thing for my client, which is you, the people of California, and keep our community safe. And it was interesting, and it was great having Pat work with me as a paralegal. I always thought, though, as I was getting a little older, that maybe a nice way to finish my career would be to try to be a judge. There's a couple ways you can do that. You can run for an open seat in an election. Judge seats at the Superior Court level are 6-year terms, and so every 6 years, if you want to take on a sitting judge, you can. That's not usually the smartest thing to do. In LA, I am told it's blood sport to go after sitting judges, but fortunately in San Diego, very, very rarely does someone take on a sitting judge. So there's value in being an incumbent. And I've been there going on 15 years now. I just have one more term to election, I should say, to get through until I reach my retirement age. And I'm not overly concerned, frankly. That's one way you can do it. I happen to do it through the appointment process. I kept telling my buddies that I was going to file for a judge. It's a 45-question application, and you know, every week I would answer a question. They kept wondering, well, when are you going to do it? I said, well, you know, it's 45 questions. It's 45 weeks. You know, this week it's my name. And then you get down to the nitty-gritty where you're talking about 5 or 6 trials that you've done, what the result was, why you thought they were important trials, why you want to be a judge, things of that nature. And those are the tougher questions to answer. But I filled out the application. I had it ready to go. I came to a deputy DA's statewide convention where Pete Wilson was going to be speaking. I was accompanied by the then-elected district attorney who, after the governor's talk, came up and introduced me. And I shook hands with Governor Wilson and said, it's nice to meet you. And I'm standing there with a dog. I figured, you know, this is an impression that'll sit with him for a minute. And I said, I'm going to be applying for a judge. And he said, oh, that's nice. Well, blah, blah. And next thing I did is drop my application in the mail the next day. So I figure with my picture stamped on the application, although he probably wouldn't see it, if ever, at least the impression would be made when the judicial secretary gets the application, hey, you've got a blind person applying to be a judge. And you know, maybe the light clicked with him. Well, I just met a guy like that. That was in June, and in the following February, I was appointed in 1998. And I had a 4-year run before I had to worry about an election, because then municipal court judges were in vogue. The consolidation didn't happen until later that year. So I got to serve out the 4-year balance of a term of a judge who had died in office. And then I have been running every six years since then. So that's how the law business went for me to where I am today. What is it like to be a judge? Well, having been a prosecutor, you know, the hat tipped one way. When you become a judge, the hat isn't supposed to tip. And I knew that, and I think I bend over backwards to make sure that I am fair in all of my rulings. Obviously, doing criminal work, the district attorney's office that I work for is in front of me every day, and I know most of the DAs. A lot of them have retired, and a lot of younger ones are coming in, so I don't know all of them, but I try to listen, which is, I think, one of the key ingredients, and fortunately, my hearing is good. I try to exercise patience, and at times, that's a little difficult with lawyers who, A, don't come to court on time, B, think they get paid by the word, and C, who have made their point in the first minute, and the next 9 minutes, I'm sort of thinking about what I'm going to have for dinner. But I look interested. And finally, since I do a high-volume criminal calendar, I just have to cut them off, and I give them my ruling, and they all say thank you. and they say, Your Honor. Isn't that nice? And then I go on to other cases. But it's been fun at times. It's frustrating and depressing at times because I see some really nasty things coming through my court. I do arraignments in the afternoon, so if it's newsworthy, I'm the guy that's going to have the cameras in court. The molest cases are heart-wrenching. There's a lot of domestic violence that goes on. There's a lot of alcohol and drug abuse that comes in the form of criminal activity, whether it's the drug itself or it's leading to violence and robberies and things of that nature. So I try to keep a poker face, not let my personal views get in the way. I try to set bail fairly at what I think is appropriate for what's before me, taking into account public safety issues and prior criminal records and things of that nature. I have an assistant that sits up on the bench with me in the afternoons because there's no time for advanced prep on arraignments. The DA is bringing the case in and the paperwork is being created for it as it comes in, and they're brought to my desk, and Soshi, who works with me now, is whispering things to me as the public defender is doing the arraigning, or the defense attorney, as the case may be. And she's telling me what the charges are, what the bail is, what the record is, what the score is for risk assessment, prior records, are they on probation, are they on parole, are they now under post-release supervision under new AB 109 stuff. And she's throwing a lot of stuff at me, and I don't have to say much. I just enter not guilty pleas. Nobody pleads guilty at arraignment. Most of the time, they don't have their lawyer with them. It's just a counseling attorney. And then I'll ask the DA to tell me a little bit about the facts. And I usually can tell, having been a DA, I know what all the crime charges are, and I can almost tell you what happened in this whole scenario just by looking at the way it's charged, you know, whether it's a stolen car and then a high-speed chase and all of a sudden the fight with the cops. You know, there's three different charges. You can pretty much tell what happened. I set bail. I asked them if they want a bail review, which is a reconsideration in 3 days if they want it. I'm generally adjusting bail at arraignment based on the charges that I see, and most people don't want to come back and see me again in 3 days, which is fine. So then they go on and the case moves along in the system. I mentioned that I'm kind of the media point of contact. Most judges will not let the media in their courtroom. They just think it's distracting, which it is. Gives attorneys a chance to showboat a little bit, and it takes away from the dignity of the courtroom in many ways, and it tends to give different influences on different aspects of the case, which probably should not be fairly given. But I let the media in because I'm the point of contact to the community, and while in some cases I may not like that, That's kind of the marching orders I have from my presiding judge. We need good relations with the media. So I let them film the arraignments. I will make them tile the face of the defendants if I think there are issues for personal safety of the defendant while in jail on certain kinds of cases, such as child molest, or if there's snitch issues where if the other inmates in jail, and they do watch TV in jail, if they think, you know, they got a bad dude in their midst, that might not be healthy for that person. Or there may be some other reasons to tile the face, and in which case you get the scrambled version of it on the news at night. And that's when I get a lot of publicity, because they don't want to put up just this scrambled tile face, so they show me. And you know, so I have to get a haircut about once a month. But it's okay, because now everybody in the little town where I live thinks that I do all these wonderful high-profile cases and I have just such a great job and I'm doing a great job for the community. And little do they know that I touched it on day one and I didn't really do the trial. And when the case does go to trial, the only film that the media has is me. And so when the case is going to a trial or going to a verdict and the judge that did the trial is doing the sentencing, the media is doing the case now, but whose face are they showing? Mine. So I get a lot of credit that I probably don't deserve there. In looking for work, I wanted to touch on this. I think, obviously, I heard that figure thrown out earlier, 70% unemployment for the blind, I guess you were referring to. Yeah, there's some challenges that way. I suppose there's two schools of thought on when applying for a job, should you tell somebody about your disability or not. When I applied, part of my resume included my stint in the military and the fact that I was very involved with the Blinded Veterans Association. So, you know, it was sort of right out there on the resume. I've rethought that a little bit, especially in light of the changes in the technology lately. Now, I don't really need a reader except for what I do in the afternoon. Sometimes I use a reader just to prepare my notes for the next morning's probation cases that I review, but all of that stuff is online now. The probation department has all of their reports online and they can email them to me. Everything involving legal research now through LexisNexis and Westlaw is all online. Computers were obviously not around when I went to law school. I have a Dell computer. I'm not pushing Dell, I just happen to like it. And that's what the office has too. So I matched my home computer to the office computer. I use JAWS. I've used JAWS from the get-go. I know Window Eyes is out there, and there may be others, but I've gotten very comfortable with JAWS. I now have OpenBook, and I have the scanner camera, the Pearl, which makes anything given to me at the last minute, which is often, lawyers never file timely, it gives me an ability to just go in and throw it under the scanner, and if you've used the Pearl, you know that within 4 seconds or so, whatever you just clicked is coming up on your computer in the OpenBook program, and I can read it. Doesn't do anything with handwritten stuff, which a lot of defendants who do their own legal work, they write out in very poor handwriting. It's very hard for even my sighted help to read. But I think what you need to do is, if you have skills, use them. If you don't, get them. Get all the education that you think you can afford or can have available to you. Use the technology and get familiar with how to use it if you aren't familiar with it, because it is a technological world now. And most anything you are going to do, you're going to have to be, I think, computer literate. I would say to try and get as much experience as you can. Sometimes you're going to have to think small first. And that may mean getting involved in volunteer groups where you can do something to demonstrate not only to yourself but to others that you have the ability to be productive at something. Use that to network with the people you meet, whether it's through organizations such as this or through community groups or church groups, other nonprofits, to try and parlay some of that knowledge, skill, and experience that you're getting and the technical skills that you have into doing something a little more interesting and more productive. Getting back to the, do you tell the employer about the disability or not? I think not, because I think if you throw that out on a resume, you have given them a reason to not even give you an interview. Especially in this day and age when competition for work is so keen and everybody is looking for a job. You are competing against other people. I think you need to get in the door, and when you get there, you dazzle them with your brilliance. If you have an ability to speak well, and I think you need to work on that, don't say like, don't say you know, things like that. Get in the door. It's going to be very difficult for you to walk for a business to have you walk in and then all of a sudden the interview isn't going to happen because all of a sudden you're standing there with a cane or a dog. I think once you can get in the interview, you can disarm them by talking about why you're there and figuratively look them in the eye and tell them, I'm the guy or the lady for this job and why. And tell them what you've done, what you can do, how well you know what their business is, how you plan to use your knowledge and experience and your technological skills, if it's called for, to do the job. And try to leave them with the impression that, okay, you're not a blind person, you are a person who has a disability, but you can probably do this job, or at least we will give you a chance. So that would be the approach I would take if I was doing it today. Kind of glad I don't have to do it today. I'm looking forward to retiring myself. But so that's the way I would leave you with that. I think also it's important for you to try to stay positive with your attitude. Be patient. I know that's a little tough at times for people, especially if you've been looking for a long time. But if you don't have a positive attitude, it's going to show right away. And people will pick up on that. And they say, oh, this person's a downer. This isn't going to help the atmosphere in this business. I would try to keep a good support system, stay healthy, stay focused. If you have good family relationships, make sure you maintain those. Your friendships are important. Try not to have too much stress in your life. Balance is important. Have some decent hobbies where you can, you know, forget about the problems that you have, but try and do some fun things. I'm a golfer. Not ready to go on tour yet, but I try to play as much golf as I can, and I'm fairly good at it for someone who can't see. And I think my buddies are ready to take a few strokes away from me on my handicap. I have my dog here, Kenny. He's number 5 for me. And my wife, Janice, is up here with me as well. And I read a lot. I like to walk. You know, you've got to find an outlet to offset the things that weigh heavily on you, and those are some of the ways that I do it. I wanted to leave some time for questions because I didn't speak specifically yet to how I actually handle evidence and things, but if you're interested in that, I'd be happy to talk about it. What I do now doesn't involve a lot of evidence. It's more listening, and that's kind of key. I most of my stuff is with defendants, and that you ask me if I, how do I know they're lying? I said, I just assume they're lying. And then I look for something that maybe tells me I'm wrong. And occasionally that happens. But in the probation arena, I'm not dealing with the really bad people. Those people hopefully are in prison. I'm dealing with people who have made bad choices. And that just means they need to have their behavior modified a little bit. And for a period of time, I get to be the modifier. And I try to do that in a fair way. I give them enough rope to hang themselves, usually. I'll let them have many chances at trying to kick drug habits, if that's it, or alcohol problems. I'll give them chances to do public work service and stay out of jail. I now have the added pressure of knowing that I don't have a whole lot of room in jail. And if there's somebody that's going to jail, I'd rather it be somebody that is hurting people as opposed to somebody who is stealing six packs of beer. So I try to find other equally unpleasant things for them to do, like clean up the freeways and inhale the exhaust fumes of cars as they go by. But, you know, if push comes to shove and they're going to do what I want them to do, then I'm going to let them cool their heels in jail for a little while. And eventually there comes a point when how much more do I want out of this case? How much more does this, the state of California want? How much more is it worth spending money? And maybe I'll just say, okay, enough is enough. I'm terminating probation. You're done. See you on the next crime. And, you know, and then maybe they'll go to prison. Who knows? Because the priors will count. So, in the evidence arena, when I was doing trials and when I did them as DA, as well as being a judge for a little while doing trials, the attorneys pretty well describe the evidence that they're trying to present to me. If it's a photograph, they can describe it to me. If it's a diagram, they can explain it to me. I work on the clock method like most of us do. Certain things are noon to 3 to 6, whatever, north, south, east, west. The relevance of it is another call. That's my call. But when it comes to things that need to be looked at, I wasn't overly concerned as long as it was admissible. Jurors are the ones that are actually evaluating it for what it really means to the case. It's just my question is, does the jury get to look at it? And so if I'm satisfied that it's relevant, I'll let them weigh it for whatever it's worth on guilt or innocence. Lawyers and I worked together very well when I was a DA. They may not agree with a lot of rulings from me or any other judge for that matter, but they rarely would show disrespect to any judge. In the first place, they could be held in contempt, and that would go on their record. And if the fine was more than $1,000, they're in serious trouble with the bar. I've never held a lawyer in contempt. I've been a DA. I know what schedules are like. I'm supposed to be in three places at once, so I'm pretty lenient at not making somebody stick to a time schedule with me as long as they call me and let me know where they are and when I can expect them. So I get along with attorneys. I get along with other judges. But it's a lonely life being a judge because I can't really associate with a lot of my friends if they're still practicing law. But most of my friends are retired, so that's not a problem. And I'm hoping to join their ranks soon. All right, I'll answer any questions, but I appreciate
you having me. We have time for two questions. The first is David Hanlon.
And I'll
I know we need to keep to a time schedule.
And I'll stay if you need me.
Okay.
Okay.
Your Honor, not being able to see the facial expression in the eyes, are you confronted with, and of course, many of these criminals and people that have problems have a tendency to lie and to be a con artist. Are you able to discern whether they're telling the truth or not in their explanation to you?
Well, I try. The district attorney is always present, and if he or she doesn't like what they see or thinks it's a bunch of hooey, they're going to say so in their own fashion in their argument. I do try to listen to the way somebody is talking to me. Usually nervous, lying people, it shows in their voice because they are nervous when they're lying. And they're not thinking fast on their feet if they're trying to make up a story as they go. But keeping in mind, the people that are in front of me talking to me usually are already convicted. So I know they did the crime. And now I want to know why they're not doing the things to stay out of jail. And I usually am thinking most of them are giving me a story. It's amazing how many people, A, suddenly get religion. How many people have family members who are on their deathbed, how they're needed at home to take care of sick grandma because nobody else is there to take care of her, even though they're out past curfew with their gangbangers. You know, so it's pretty easy to tell, for me anyway, when somebody is feeding me a line just because they want to get out of jail.
Okay, before we take our last question from Mary Lou Baracco, is Mark Turner in the room? Our next speaker, if you could make your way up to the front while we take this last question. Okay, Mary Lou.
Thank you. Your Honor, I was wondering, was there ever an unfortunate time when you may have lawyers saying, look, I don't want this gentleman, you know, trying cases, and, you know, how did you handle this, or how do you deal with that? When you have lawyers, or
you mean a specific lawyer that I didn't think should be in front of me?
Yeah, and they said, "Look, I don't want him. You know, I feel his blindness. You know, as a, and they say this outright. You know, how do you handle him?"
Okay, you mean somebody who have a prejudice against me?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I've never had that. No.
That's good.
No. No. But, you know, in fairness, though, you got to remember, I've done this now for, 25, 26 years. I know the law. I've always felt a fair prosecutor. I've dealt fairly with the defense bar. When I applied to be a judge, you go through the judicial nominating process, and the defense bar gets to weigh in on you. And they get a form, and they get to ding you before you're ever even thought of being selected by the governor. And if there are things they don't like about you, it's anonymous. There's no holds barred. And they will tell you what they don't like. And you have to sit in front of two lawyers in a final interview, and they don't tell you about all the good things. They say there's these four or five things that the legal community here thinks about you. What do you say to that? And so I answered whatever the problems they felt I had, apparently satisfactorily, because I did get appointed. But, you know, there's politics involved. No, it hasn't been a problem. I have a great relationship with both the defense bar and the DAs.
And if everyone can please turn off those cell phones, I would appreciate it.
Yeah, I confiscate those in court. I try to evaluate which ones are the better phones to have.
Yeah. You know, I'd like to do that. I'd like to do that in here. You know, we'd have a volunteer kind of scheduled to, you know, where does it come from? And, you know, they could pick them up, and then we could really do some great door prizes.
I will say that I use a cell phone, but I use it solely as a phone. I do text once in a while. But I don't want the internet access on a phone, and I don't really need it because I'm at my chambers or I'm at home, and I'm always at my computer, so I don't really need that.
Well, everyone, please join me in thanking Judge Domowski for coming today.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I didn't catch your name.
Donna Pomeranz,
President
of the
County. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. All right.
Thank you. All right.
stay in the back a few minutes.
Judge Sumowski says that he will be in the back if anyone wishes to speak with him. So thank you so much.